three journeys. The first journey is inward. Its adventure is the discovery of the self. Self-knowledge is its end, and it leads outward. The second journey is outward. Its adventure is the discovery of others. Compassion and empathy, a sense of involvement and understanding are its ends. And it leads inward. The third journey is inward again. Its adventure is the discovery of the universal, eternal. A sense of wonder and mystery are its ends. And it leads outward. Ed Searle is able to describe the ways that our inner work and our outer work are profoundly connected, that they are mutually interdependent, as Alan Watts said in the piece that we listened to a few weeks ago, meaning that the inner work and the outer work arise together, call each other into being. So as our own spiritual lives deepen, it gives us the capacity to deepen our engagement with the world. That is why all churches, all religious and spiritual communities have a unique capacity to provide the energy for profound social change in the world. Because the drive for change needs to be sustained by something more than just the longing for things to be different. Last week, I articulated the first half of my vision for what church life here in the 21st century looks like. And I shared my thinking in response to the article that I sent out in the E-Fuse by Reverend Anna Levy Lyons, a UU minister in New York City, who charged us to build a counterculture in our liberal congregations. She's talking about the spiritually grounded, emotionally vibrant, intellectually challenging resistance to what is around us that does not make sense. And I want us to respond to her call to restore that radical edge and the dynamic energy of religious liberalism. Last week, I talked about this being a place where we can talk about anything. And that means learning to listen deeply and learning to expect that other people will listen to what we have to say. And that part of listening, part of working together, means also learning not to take things personally. So that first idea, I think, is also that church is a place where we get to practice being human together. And my second vision for church life is that every person here have a spiritual practice, that it be something that each of us finds our own practice that suits us. There are perhaps a million different practices available to you in the world, and you can find one that is right for you and return to it again and again so that your mind learns that there is something there that offers steadiness. In thinking about having a spiritual practice, I wanted to share the words of Brené Brown, who is being read and listened to quite a bit these days, as she describes what spirituality is. Spirituality is recognizing and celebrating that we are all inextricably connected to each other by a power greater than all of us, and that our connection to that power and to one another is grounded in love and compassion. practicing spirituality brings a sense of perspective, meaning, and purpose to our lives. Many people now say that they are spiritual but not religious. Maybe half of, I won't make you identify, but probably about half the people in the room would say some version of that if asked about it. So I think it's useful to have a definition of what spirituality is, that amorphous thing. Just as Tony observed that our unison benediction is about what each of us will do in our own relationship with the world and our own understanding of life, the first two parts of the vision that I articulated are really focused more on what each of us will do as individuals. They, of course, impact the congregation, but they're about individual practice and understanding. And the second two practices of congregational life are about what we'll do together, how we'll work together. So the third one is that this be a place of collective action. It looks to me like all of our social justice causes are interrelated. You can't work on racism without working on environmental issues. You can't work on global climate change without working on economic inequality. You can't work on economic inequality without working on sexism. You can't work on women's health issues without working on violence in our society. And you can't work on violence in our society without working on racism, which gets us back to the beginning of this circle. Add whichever issue you want, it fits into this circle of things that are interrelated. So I begin to think that it matters a little less which issue we work on than that we choose something and work diligently together on that something. And by together, I mean, my vision for church life is that we choose an aspect of the world that needs help and work collectively on it for a year or two or maybe longer. That we all focus our energies, our education, our meditations on that one area of the world. That we give our money to that we give our attention to that, and see if by working together we can make something happen that individually we cannot. I would not be in the ministry if I did not believe in and have some real experience of the power of collective action. It is fantastic to work by yourself on something that you love. But something happens when a group works together toward a goal. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And this congregation has certainly done this. This year in October, you organized a rally on the steps of the town hall downtown about gun violence, and there were 30 or 40 people there every week. And there was some response to that in the world. This congregation has engaged in the ongoing work of Green Sanctuary. And you became a welcoming congregation so that you could indeed welcome people at whatever stage of understanding and wherever they are in their lives about being gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual, questioning. And this congregation did a lot of work to support marriage equality in this state. We may not agree completely on the solutions, but this is a place where we can actively encounter the parts of our society to which we should be maladjusted and engage those things, even if we don't have a singular answer. Did you hear that there were tens of thousands of people marching in Raleigh, North Carolina yesterday? And did you hear that 1,000 of those people were Unitarian Universalists, wearing yellow shirts that said, "Standing on the Side of Love"? When I went to investigate this march, I had a little trouble figuring out exactly what they were marching about. And I finally discovered that they were marching about 12 things, and that's why it was hard to figure out exactly what they were marching about. The march was organized by the NAACP, and they were taking on some voter ID laws that looked discriminatory. They were also protesting the fact that the public schools have been defunded. They've also are protesting the fact that the mental health system is not being funded properly. They're talking about some women's health issues that are lively in that state at the moment. There were a lot of things to march about, and they got themselves organized, and there were 1,000 of us there, which is pretty good. There were reports about this march in quite a few of the national news sources, so you can go home and Google it. And I was proud that there were so many Unitarian Universalists there. I think that UUs like to complain about ourselves, talk about how skeptical we are about everything, how we read ahead in the hymnal to see if we agree with the words that are coming up in the hymn. I've done it. We joke about how reserved and over-analytical we are, and it was great to see 1,000 of us out in the streets wearing bright yellow shirts that say, "Standing on the Side of Love." Many Unitarian Universalists have those shirts, and I think we might need to stock up on them in our congregation, because you cannot go wrong with that as a social justice claim. The world is so hungry for people to joyfully, openly, consistently say that they are standing on the side of love. So let's do that. I think that's something that this congregation can do. One of the people who is good at doing this, I guess I have to say was good at doing this, was Pete Seeger. And as I said last week, he was a Unitarian Universalist, a member of a congregation for many years in New York. And although I encountered him as someone who sang about unions, he had come to believe passionately in the work to save the environment and had really made that his whole focus. He had a boat built to sail the Hudson and had that boat named the Clearwater, so that the boat would inspire that in the river. If you know anything about the Hudson River, you know that clear water is not always how it was described. He used this beautiful boat to run educational trips for children, but also to draw other people to this idea of a cleaner world, people who weren't automatically on board for a cleaner world. I heard an interview with him last week, as people were remembering him after his death, on a radio program called Living on Earth. And the host asked him how he had gotten involved in the environmental movement. And Pete said, "It was Rachel Carson's famous book, Silent Spring. I read it in The New Yorker in installments." Did anyone else read Silent Spring in installments in The New Yorker? I was fascinated to learn, getting one vote. I was fascinated to learn that it had been published that way. That's me talking, not Pete. Back to Pete. Pete said, "Up until then, I'd thought that the main job to do was to help the meek inherit the earth. And I still think that's a job that's got to be done, but I realized if we didn't do something pretty soon, what the meek would inherit would be a pretty poisonous place to live." Pete Seeger went on to say, "Saving the world is not going to be easy. It's going to require huge arguments. People who call themselves environmentalists don't always agree. One says, 'Don't have any dams.' But along comes a man who says, Well, if you have a lot of small dams, they won't do any damage, and or not that much, and it would save burning fossil fuels. Who knows what's going to happen? All I know is that I wish I could live another 30 or 40 years, because some of the most exciting things are going to happen then. When I meet people who say, "Oh, there's no hope, Peter. Look at the things that are going wrong." And I say, "Well, what's going on?" And they say, "I just don't know how to handle this. There is no hope." But I say to them, "Did you think that our great Watergate president would leave office the way he did?" "No, I guess I didn't think that." "Did you think that the Berlin Wall would come down so peacefully?" "No, I didn't think that would happen." "Did you think that Mandela would be the president of South Africa?" "No, I did not predict that." "Well, if you couldn't predict those three things, then don't be so confident that there's no hope." And then I give them a bumper sticker that says, "There's no hope, but I might be wrong." My husband and I were listening to this segment together, and he is now threatening to get a large batch of those bumper stickers printed up so we can have our Standing on the Side of Love t-shirts with our "There's No Hope, But We Might Be Wrong" t-shirt bumper stickers. Well, Pete's story leads me right into the fourth thing that I think is essential for church life in this world at this moment: that we be a place of ultimate hope. James Luther Adams, Unitarian Universalist social ethicist, said that the resources, both human and divine, justify an attitude of ultimate optimism. I choose the word hope rather than optimism, but not sure that the exact word is essential here. What is essential is that liberal religious communities turn our minds and our attention toward what in our world transcends loss and destruction. I talked about Alan Watts a couple of weeks ago and about the concern that many people have about not appearing to break the social rules, not making mistakes. And I'm pretty sure that being outwardly hopeful or optimistic is to risk being disappointed, to risk being told that you are wrong, or maybe even worse than wrong, naive. And I think that that's a mistake we might risk making. You might remember I did a series of sermons on James Luther Adams a few years ago, and I preached about this idea that the resources available justify an attitude of ultimate optimism. And I told a story that I think Pete Seeger should have added to his list of stories, except it takes a little longer to tell. It's the story of the Berkeley Pit in Butte, Montana. Do you remember this story about the mining pit in Montana? A few of you have been hanging on to that story. Well, the Berkeley Pit used to be a mountain until our country decided to string electrical wires from sea to shining sea, and they needed copper. And so they mined the copper out of that mountain, among others, and turned the mountain into a pit. Pretty ugly one at that. And then when the mining stopped, they stopped pumping the groundwater out of the pit mines and left a pit slowly filling up with water. Water rising up out of the ground and running off of the surrounding mountainsides. And the water dissolved substances in the rock so that it wasn't just water anymore, but kind of an acidy mix in there. And that, in turn, dissolved other things in the rock, like arsenic and cadmium and things that you wouldn't want in your swimming pool. So the Berkeley Pit is just a huge pool of poison. And the water keeps rising. They're predicting that I think in 2023, it will rise high enough that it will go over the edge, and then that water will be flowing everywhere. Needless to say, people weren't feeling hopeful if they were living near the Berkeley Pit. So scientists began to study that water, began to study how it could be cleaned and what it was really composed of and how it interacted with the rock. And people were noticing that that water was still killing things, like a flock of snow geese who had to land there in a winter storm. They were trapped for a day or so and drank some of the water, and they all died. And there was some uproar in the area about the fact that this toxic pool was allowed to be open like this and kill things. Well, the scientists kept studying the water in the hopes that they could figure something out. And one of them was down by the water one day and noticed that there was a stick floating in the water that was covered with green slime, which in this case is a really hopeful sign. That green slime, which we don't usually get excited to see, is algae growing on a stick. So they took it back to the lab and they studied it, and they tried to figure out exactly where this algae had come from that was living in this toxic, acidic, heavy metal-laden pool. And it was an algae and a fungus, and they had to look around for a while to figure out where it had come from, and finally discovered that the source of this particular microorganism that was, in fact, eating the heavy metals in the water, that was living on the poison and cleaning it up in the process, that this little organism had come from the digestive tract of geese. So you just never know what is going to happen next. It seems like there's no hope, and then you find out you might be wrong. And we might feel as individuals on any given day that there's not enough hope anyway, or enough reasons to think that things might be all right. And I propose that as a church, as a spiritual community, as a place where we gather collectively, that we make a claim for hope in the world. That we make a claim for what is possible, for what keeps appearing everywhere, from microorganisms in poison lakes to Nelson Mandela to the fragments of the Berlin Wall to our fellow Unitarian Universalists marching for justice. Some people call this ultimate hope. Some people call this God. Some people call this darn good luck. Some people say that it's just the laws of physics unfolding in our lives. And it is interesting to discuss why we each think what we talk about is hope. But I think what's most important is that we keep ourselves collectively focused on what transcends what is destructive or a loss in our world, and that we kindle it for each other, just as we kindle our chalice each week, and that we do indeed take that out into the world, as I ask you to do each week, that we are collectively persistent and joyful about the possibility that there is hope for the world. Pete Seeger, again, he's a good source. If you feel like hope is flagging, go to Pete Seeger. He says, the key to the future of the world is finding the optimistic stories and letting them be known. So that's our work as a congregation, I think. Even if we as individuals get discouraged, it's our work to find those optimistic stories and tell them. And hope is as often a visceral thing. So we need to sing and dance and laugh together. I think that the intellectual pursuits are not sufficient to encompass all that we have to face with the amount of danger and fear and discouragement that is in the world. So we need to do all kinds of things to keep that hope shining brightly. We need to have this be a place where we can talk about anything, where we can be vulnerable and present with each other and learn to be centered and not take things personally so that we can shine with hope. We need our spiritual practices to keep us steady in this tumultuous world. And we have to work together, take action together so that we can keep each other strong and bold. These are the words of Thomas Merton. You do not need to know precisely what is happening or exactly where it is all going. What you need is to recognize the possibilities and challenges offered by the present moment and embrace them with courage, faith, and hope.